Five. So let's get started. We are going to, I don't know, show of hands, anybody here planning on going to watch the eclipse? Quite a few people. So where, and everybody has your glasses, okay. So we're going to try to finish with enough time for people to go outside and watch the eclipse. You should have plenty of time. I think the peak is at 3:23. So we'll be done. It's also a shorter shiur, so it all happens to work out. Just a couple of housekeeping announcements. Number one is someone asked, I had sent out an email this morning that we were going to meet, and someone said, well, can you send out the notification earlier? Because people need to know if we're meeting. So we meet every other week on Mondays at 2 p.m. The email is just a reminder, but it's not the announcement, oh, hey, we happen to be meeting. Well, the meeting is every other week on Mondays at 2 p.m. Although on 2 weeks is Erev Pesach, so we're going to have to wait. We're going to suspend our shiur till after Pesach. So at that point, I'll send out another email about meeting. But generally, unless otherwise noted, we will meet every other Monday at 2 p.m. And we spoke last time about this the idea of having windows in a shul, and kind of tangentially, we noted that I think because there was a picture on the cover of a shul that had beautiful stained glass windows, as there are many throughout the world, tangentially we spoke a little bit about whether it's advisable, permissible, appropriate to have stained glass windows in a synagogue. So I thought that maybe we could spend, we spend a lot of time talking about tefillah. This is something that has to do with the shul, which is the main tefillah institution. So maybe we would spend at least one class looking a little bit more closely and clearly, no pun intended, at the idea of stained glass windows in the synagogue. So that's what we'll talk about today. I'm sorry that there's no graphic or anything like that. And then you can go, you can all go watch the eclipse with proper protection, of course, because it's supposed to be very bad. I'm not a doctor here, but I see there are some doctors here, but it's supposed to be very bad for your eyes. Okay, great. So, yeah. So let's get started. And the truth is that in order to talk about stained glass windows in shul, we really need to take a step back and talk about stained glass windows anywhere. Where do stained glass windows come from? Where did they originate? What? So there are a lot of stained glass windows in churches. There are a lot of stained glass windows in churches, but the history of stained glass windows is older than the history of Christianity. And I'm certainly no expert in this. All of the information that I'm about to share comes from Wikipedia and other such, the Museum of Natural History website and things like that. But in any case, actually, probably not the Museum of Natural History website, but some different educational sources. So the truth is that as far back as ancient Rome, and really as far back as ancient Egypt, people were assembling glass and coloring glass and using it into pattern window in pattern window frames. Certainly in ancient Rome, that's something that they were doing. It did not necessarily have anything to do with religious worship. This was just part of a beautiful decoration that could adorn your house or could adorn anything that you wanted to create. Stained glass windows in religious worship originate around the 4th or the 5th century, maybe even earlier. No one knows when the first stained glass building was built, or window was built. But certainly in Europe, at least, the art of stained glass windows reached a peak between 1150 and 1500. That's when many, if not most, cathedrals were created with some massive stained glass windows, the kinds of things that you might see in photographs or on a vacation, or the iconic famous windows on these churches, massive stained glass windows, most of the time originated in the years 1150 to 1500. Now, since then, maybe many of them have been refurbished or they've been ruined and had to be redesigned. But for the first time, we were seeing these windows peak around that time in Europe. It's hard to tell when this practice was adopted by synagogues. I'm just curious, if you had to, all of us have spent time in multiple synagogues, and I'm curious if you had to put your finger on it, if you had to talk about American shuls, what percentage would you guess of American shuls have stained glass windows in the sanctuary? What would you guess? No, total, altogether. What would you guess? What percentage?
More than 90.
More than 90%. Right, not the little shtiblach, but we can count those. Some Hasidic shuls do have stained glass windows, if I recall correctly. I don't want to throw any under the bus, but okay. So the truth is, it was kind of an unfair question because I don't have the answer to your question. It's just something I was curious about because my perception is totally that in a significant proportion of shuls in the United States, there are stained glass windows. There are stained glass windows in Lower Merion Synagogue. They're fake. They're not to the outside. There's a light beam bar behind them, but there are stained glass windows.
I can't recollect ever being in a shul with a plain glass window in the...
Really? So, it's hard to tell exactly when this phenomenon became so widespread in American synagogues, but certainly by the 1800s, we have examples of American shuls using stained glass windows as their part of their architecture. What does seem to be clear, again, no pun intended, but what does seem to be clear is that, at least in Europe, this practice was in churches before it was in shuls. And it might have been in other places before it was in churches, but it was certainly in churches before it was in shuls. And stained glass has become an emblematic or even an iconic part of worship in many religious chapels, whether they be synagogues, whether they be churches, whatever it is. And that raises a number of halachic and philosophical questions about the presence and role of stained glass windows in shuls. So when we're talking about this, what kinds of issues might you anticipate? What do you think? What kind of issues might you anticipate? I'm talking about stained glass windows in shuls. What kind of issues might come up? Yeah. Sure. So, Darkei Emori, what we call Chukos Akum, following in the ways of non-Jews. Yeah?
Subject matter,
meaning what's on the windows?
Sure.
What Judaism does not allow the depiction of everything under the sun, also a pun, because one of the things that some posts can prohibit drawing is, in fact, the sun. So a lot of these things have images on them, sometimes biblical scenes reenacted on them. So that's an interesting question. Absolutely. Yeah? Anything else? Okay. So we got most of it, and as you'll see, there's one issue that I don't think anybody would have guessed that we'll look at the end, which is, I think, the most fascinating issue. But you were right, Mr. Wolfish, that the truth is that probably the first one that comes to mind is the pasuk in Vayikra, Perek Yud Ches Pasuk Gimel, the first source on the sheet. Ma'asei Eretz Mitzrayim lo yashavtem ba'lo sa'asuch ma'asei Eretz Kanaan asher ani mevi'eschem shama lo sa'asuch v'chukosehem lo se'lechu. That you should not copy the practices of Egypt. You shouldn't copy the practices of the nations that live in the land of Canaan. You should follow your own practices. You should not adopt the practices of the non-Jewish nations that surround you. And this is not just what we would call a harash, Sha'a, a time-limited decree given to the Jews when they were entering the Holy Land. This is a mitzvah. The Rambam writes that in every generation, it's a mitzvah. You're not allowed to follow or imitate the practices of non-Jews. Okay, so that's a mitzvah. So maybe you can say, well, if this is a non-Jewish practice that non-Jews started, maybe it would be prohibited to use stained glass windows because of the prohibition of what you said, Darkei Emori or Chukos Akum. It's all the same thing of following and imitating the paths of the non-Jews. The only problem with this, and it's an issue that is endemic to many questions of Chukos Akum, and these are not uncommon questions, is at what point is something actually considered to be prohibited on account of non-Jewish practices? Non-Jews started wearing jeans. Okay, does that mean that you're never allowed to wear jeans? Obviously not. Obviously it's fine. Don't worry. It's obviously, it's fine. And non-Jews started wearing hats. Does that mean Jews are not allowed to wear hats? No, the opposite. Now it's only the Jews who wear hats sometimes. So again, it's hard to tell at what point, just from the basis of this pasuk, something is actually a problem because of Chukos Akum. And the truth is that the Shulchan Aruch codifies this in source number 2, in Yoredeyah Siman Kufayin Chasif Aleph. The Ramah says, based on a tshuva of the Maharik, Rabbi Yosef Kolon, the Maharik was asked a fascinating question about an academic gown. Does an academic gown, is that a violation of following the practices of non-Jews? And he has a tshuva, and the Ramah quotes this tshuva. The Ramah quotes it a little bit differently than the Maharik says it, which is its own interesting discussion. But let's just look at the Ramah for now. The Ramah says, "Ela yehe muvdal." The second paragraph, "Mehem b'malbushov u'v'shar ma'asav." You should be different from the non-Jews in the way that you dress and in the other things that you do. However, very important, "V'chol ze'eino aser." It's only prohibited, "Ela b'davar shenaha gubo ha'ov de'kochav m'shem pritzus." If it was something that idolaters adopted for the sake of licentiousness, then it's a problem. So he says there's a practice, Shehagosh Anu Nagu Levosh Malbushim Adumim, who Malbush Sari with Adom Elizeh, because it was apparently a practice that people would wear red to draw attention to themselves as a sign of grandeur. So that level of promiscuity where you're trying to attract attention is not appropriate, and therefore it would be forbidden under the laws of Chukos Akum. So it's not anything that the non-Jews do. It has to either be A, something that the non-Jews do for the sake of promiscuity, or, and this is the most interesting clause, I think, "Bedavar shenahagu leminhag ulachok ve'ein tam bedavar," or something that non-Jews do, and we don't know why they do it. They just happen to do it. "Te'ika lemeichash be mishum darchei ha'amori v'sheyesh bar shemetz avodas kochavim yavoteim." Because if you don't know why they're doing something, you have to worry that maybe it originated in some sort of pagan ritual, and by imitating that practice, you are unintentionally, unwittingly engaging in some long-held idolatrous practice or ritual or belief or something like that. So to summarize, the Ramah says, don't worry, it's not a problem of Chukos Akum. Not just start taking the bus, you're not allowed to take the bus. No, you're allowed to do things that people in general society are doing, but there are two exceptions. Number one, if that is something that they do for promiscuity's sake, that's not appropriate. That would be a violation of Chukos Akum. Or number two, if it's something that doesn't have a clear reason. So obviously, someone wants to drive a car, there's a reason for that. It's so convenient. You can go exactly where you need to go. You can start exactly where you needed to start. So there's a good reason to drive a car, so you would be permitted to drive a car. But if it's the kind of thing that has no clear reason or basis, so then the Ramah says you have to be concerned that it originates in some idolatrous rite, and then you're going to have to be machmir. What's a good example of something that non-Jews do for no apparent reason? I'm trying to think. Something that happens in American society, I'm sure there are examples. Is that there are certain things that we are not permitted to do because non-Jews do them. It's something that's for pritzus, for promiscuity's sake, or something that has no clear reason. So now we can, in theory, start to address the question of stained glass windows. Again, because according to this, to these guidelines that the Ramah sets out, and this is how he would paskin halacha l'maisa. Tosfos disagrees with this. Tosfos has another idea, but this is how he paskin l'maisa. So, are stained glass windows idolatrous? Are they a problem? Well, okay, they're not promiscuous. There's nothing promiscuous about, unless the image on a stained glass window is promiscuous, but you could have a stained glass window that is a picture of, a Torah or something like that. It doesn't have to be a promiscuous item. And the truth is, yeah, stained glass windows do happen to be eye-catching, but they're eye-catching architecturally. They're not promiscuous. So, therefore, they would not be subject to the Ramah's first condition. But are they a custom without a reason? So that's harder to tell. It doesn't seem, we don't know that stained glass windows were used in idolatry, or I'll say this differently, I don't know that stained glass windows were used in idolatrous rituals. Or certainly I don't know that that's where it originated. Maybe an expert in stained glass would be able to tell you the answer to that question, but it's not clear to me. It seems that, therefore, maybe you would have to be machmir. You don't know where this comes from. It's possible that it comes from something idolatrous, and we don't know what the reason is for it. We don't know why people use stained glass windows, so maybe it would be a problem. But the truth is, the reason is, I think, very clear. There's a very clear reason why people use stained glass windows, and that is the aesthetic beauty. There's something beautiful about color. There are studies that show, by the way, that every year there is less and less color in the world. Advertisements, billboards, buildings. People used to be more colorful. The world used to be more colorful. More and more businesses are opting for black and gray and white as fonts and as branding colors. The world is becoming less colorful. But color is beautiful in a lot of ways. And so therefore, maybe you can argue that stained glass windows have a very clear reason for people using them, and that's because they're beautiful. And when, certainly during the daytime, when they create sort of this aura in the synagogue where the light filters through, it can be very, very pretty. So I would think that stained glass windows are not chukosaku because they're not licentious or promiscuous, and they have a clear reason. People do it because it looks pretty. And so therefore, maybe we can say that stained glass windows are not a custom without a reason. Sure. I will say that some prominent rabbis, Rabbi Solomon Klein of Colmar, who was the chief rabbi of France at a conference, I believe, in 1856, he listed Chukot Hagoyim as one of the reasons to prohibit organs in synagogues. Organs in synagogues was a battle that is no longer being fought, but was a big battle at the time. People wanted to introduce organs or were a prominent part of the church service in many places, and people wanted to bring in organs into the synagogue. And so one of the reasons this rabbi said for not bringing in organs into the synagogue, he had a lot, was chukos agoyim, was following in the ways of non-Jews. Well, that's not promiscuous, and an organ is beautiful, so seemingly maybe you could say it's the same as stained glass windows, and he thought that was usser. Okay, yesh ma la'ayin b'davar, there's room to look into this further, but seemingly the minhag of America, the minhag ha'olam, is not to be concerned for this. The minhag is to have stained glass windows in many shuls, including at ours, and therefore, on a halachic level, there does not seem to be any issue. There does not seem to be any issue with stained glass windows, because again, even if you want to say it's a chukos hagoyim issue, well, chukos hagoyim has strict parameters. It doesn't seem to fit those parameters because it's not promiscuous, and it has something that seems to have a clear reason. Now, regardless of the strict halachic limitations that might apply to stained glass windows, there was one figure that we have to be honest about. There was one figure that demonstrated a clear distaste for the practice of stained glass windows in shuls on strong philosophical grounds. Does anybody want to take a guess at who that might be? Rabbi Soloveitchik is correct. Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, whose grandnephew was just our scholar in residence this past week, was not happy, and he wrote in several places that he was not happy about the institution of stained glass windows in synagogue. He doesn't make a halachic argument against it. He has a theological, philosophical argument against it. He actually writes, and we'll look at what he says in just a minute, he actually writes that using stained glass windows in synagogues actually is contrary to the message and the purpose of Jewish prayer. How so? So let's look. On the bottom of page number one, you'll see a source called Tfilatam Shel HaYehudim. Tfilatam Shel HaYehudim was an article that Rav Soloveitchik, also affectionately referred to as the Rav, that the Rav wrote in a journal, a Torah journal called Ma'ayanot Torah Journal, in the eighth volume. There were not that many volumes, but he wrote an article called Tfilah of the Jews, where he charts basically what Jewish prayer should look like, what it shouldn't look like. And at the very end, and I'm going to read it in English because his language in Hebrew is very flowery, and he has a beautiful paragraph juxtaposing the predominant Christian or Catholic church service with the Jewish synagogue experience. And this is what he writes, bottom page number one. He says, in our synagogues, this is kind of a rip on on churches, which seems, I guess, in his imagination, to have more dim lighting as sort of an ambient kind of thing. In our synagogues, the light is not even halfway dim. The lucent light as the sun is not at all concealed by colored and narrow windows. That's a reference to stained glass windows right there. In our synagogues, there are no echoes of the organ, and the songs of the mixed choir is hidden from the eyes of the worshippers. In order to generate a mysterious aura, nothing like that. We never strove to remove the Jew from reality and cause him to encounter spirits. Nay, the opposite is true. We have always asked him that the prayer be an outgrowth of his life, one on which he acknowledges the truth. Therefore, the entire Catholic Christian display of prayer is so foreign to our religious perspective, and therefore the halacha has mounted such great opposition to what is called the modernization of prayer, which protests the unique source of prayer as a worship of the heart. Anybody want to take a gander and summarize what the point he's making here? What do you think? Read on it a little bit. I think he's making a point here about Christian worship. He's saying, if you think about the choreography of, and I admittedly I've never been to one, it's about creating an elevated experience. It's about people are coming in, they're dealing with all sorts of things and problems in their life. They come into church, they should find a space that is inspiring where they can forget about all of that. It's sensationalistic, to use another word. There's an organ and there's a choir and it's loud and there's all this color from the refracted light from the stained glass windows. That's what the Rav says is what a Catholic service or a Christian service looks like. That is not supposed to be what a Jewish service looks like. In his words, the Torah, we have always asked him, the prayer be an outgrowth of his life. You don't come into the synagogue to escape from everyday life. You come to the synagogue to use your everyday experiences to connect to God and to try to make those experiences better through prayer. To have such a sensational, fantastical environment for prayer that sort of removes the individual from the context of reality is to deny the importance of connecting to your reality in communicating with God. You want to create an experience in the shul where you walk off the street and you're still thinking about your problems, because that's exactly what you're supposed to do in tefillah. You're supposed to take your problems and turn to God. You're not supposed to check them at the door so that you can have a concert. Yeah. A lot of pomp and circumstance, and what he says at the end, the unique source of prayer is a worship of the heart. The Torah, that's avodah shebalev, zohi tefillah. That's what the Torah says. That's how Chazal explain it. That tefillah is a worship of the heart. It's not a worship of the senses, of the sounds and the sights. It's a worship of the heart. And therefore, the most optimal environment, please come in, the most optimal environment for tefillah is a space which is more or less normal, which is more or less just a regular place. Some chairs, a place to daven, okay, you can have some nice architecture, but the main point is to create a service where people are not escaping from their issues or from their problems to experience God or to experience religion, but they're using their problems as a surface area or as a jumping off point or as an entry portal into a relationship with God. Okay? Is that clear? Okay. That's what Rav Soloveitchik writes in his beautiful essay, Tfilatam Shel HaYehudim. This was not the only communication of Rav Soloveitchik in which he references stained glass windows, and it's not even the first. Even earlier, in 1950, the same thing took place. The backstory here, in 1952, Cornell University, any Cornell graduates here? Cornell University, which is in Ithaca, New York, opened an interfaith chapel on its Ithaca campus. This was the result of a long and protracted discussion about how to best accommodate all the different religions in an interfaith chapel. And I just want to quote to you from Stephen Fine, who's a professor at Revel, which is YU's Graduate School of Jewish Studies, who wrote an article about this. The Cornell Chapel was part of a growing trend in post-war America, giving expression in stone, glass, and wood to the newly developing American religious triumvirate of Protestantism, Catholicism, and Judaism. Among those consulted in the course of the long and protracted discussions was none other than Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Someone had written to him as part of this plan to build an interfaith chapel,
asking him, apparently someone had suggested that they put biblical figures on the stained glass windows in the chapel. And they wanted to, they sent a letter to the Rav, is that okay? Can we do that? Is that, because we want Jews to feel included in this place. So can we have that and have Jews feel included? And the truth is, Rav Soloveitchik wrote them back a letter, and he said, I actually don't know why you're asking me only about the stained glass windows, but the truth is, I think the entire enterprise of an interfaith chapel is deeply problematic and antithetical to Judaism. And he wrote a long letter that we have. It was published in the book Covenant, Commitment, and Community, or Community, Commitment, and Covenant. There's some arrangement of those three C words. And this is what he writes on the back of the source sheet on page number 2. He says, and he's talking here about not the problem of the interfaith chapel in general, but he's talking about the specific issue of biblical images and stained glass windows. He says, an anthropomorphic symbol which will form part of the decoration of a stained glass window, which in itself is a purely ecclesiastical motif reminiscent of the medieval Gothic cathedrals, regardless of the universal character of the figures, will immediately, by the sheer law of association, be identified with the usual Christological motif. It's an interesting point he's making. He says, even if you want to say it's mutter to use a stained glass window in an interfaith chapel, intrinsically it may not be not Jewish, but by virtue of association, when people think of regal stained glass, they think of medieval Gothic Christian architecture. He says, by sheer virtue of association, it's going to aesthetically put the interfaith chapel outside the bounds of Jewish aesthetic architecture. This chapel will certainly be fashioned in the style of church architecture rather than that of a synagogue, and the human figures, made by an artist who specializes in church decorations, no doubt, will most probably display some characteristic features of church paintings that will eclipse their universal meaning. He says, even if you do have them, first of all, the guy who designs them is obviously, what is this guy doing? His livelihood is designing stained glass windows for churches. So he's obviously going to make it in a way that will probably eclipse some of their universal meaning and make it a little bit more Christian than Jews would be comfortable with. Therefore, my recommendation would not be not to agree to any representation of the human form in spite of its universal character. And then later on in the letter, he says, the whole organization of the service and the arrangement of its surrounding, like the passive role of the audience, the soft music of the organ, the stained glass window, our topic, and the Gothic style of the architecture, serve one purpose, namely the intensification of a feeling of supernaturalness, strangeness, and meta-rationality. Similar to what he writes in Tfilatam Shel HaYehudim, that the purpose of the organ and the stained glass windows and the choir, all of that is to remove the person from the experiences of life and give them some sort of magical, fantastical religious experience. But that is not the Jewish way. In contrast to this, the Jewish service is distinguished by its simplicity. It asserts itself in a dialogue between God and man on the level of this worldliness and concreteness. It is conducted in an atmosphere of rationality, familiarity, and naturalness. Hence, I am unable to comprehend how it is possible to dedicate a chapel to two mutually exclusive ways of worship, and how one could reconcile the Jewish service with alien architectural surroundings that symbolize the mysterium magnum of the Eucharist. Right. Well-written words, as always, by Rav Soloveitchik, who, by the way, was not born speaking English. So that he wrote like this is very impressive. In any case, what he's saying here is again the same point: is that in contrast to the sophistication and the sensationalism of the Christian Catholic service, the Jewish service is marked by its simplicity. We don't need the singing. We don't need the organs. We need a person to come in and have a conversation with God. That is the purpose. So it's nice. But it can't detract from the purpose of tefillah. You don't fulfill your obligation of tefillah when you listen to a chazan chant a melody. You fulfill your obligation of tefillah when you have a conversation with God. And so to have a service where you are supposed to elevate yourself above your reality self and experience some sort of enlightened spiritual state, in order to communicate with God. That is not the way Judaism works. Judaism is kind of the opposite. Judaism says, no, it's through experiencing your normal life with all of the problems that it contains that you can merit to become an elevated human being. But it's not that you become an elevated human being so that you can communicate with God. It's the opposite. It's you communicate with God and that makes you into an elevated human being. And so therefore, what you need in a shul is nothing more than a pew and some books and obviously a Torah and all the things that you need to perform ritual functions. But you don't need the sensationalism of the church, because the Jewish rite, the Jewish ritual, and the Jewish tefillah requires just you and an earnest desire to communicate with God. Okay, fine. Again, these are not necessarily halachic issues. These are more philosophical issues. But it's clear that the Rav was not in favor of stained glass windows because he thought it contributed to an aura and a style of worship that is antithetical to the Jewish experience of prayer. There is one potential issue with stained glass windows, and with this we'll end, which is that, as we noted last time, it's imperative to daven in a room with windows, right? Remember that. That was what the Gemara tells us, based on Sefer Daniel, where Daniel went and he davened in a room with windows. Do stained glass windows count as windows? Do stained glass windows count as windows to fulfill this imperative that you should daven in a room with windows? Well,
do they have glass in that room? Remember this?
You're thinking like Rashi. The truth is, it depends on what the reason for the windows are. Remember last time, the bottom of page number 2, Rashi writes, you have to have windows. The windows allow you to look towards the heavens, to look towards the sky, and that will help you feel inspired and submissive. So if you hold like Rashi, where the window actually has to be a viewing portal into the sky, it's kind of what you're saying, so you have to be able to look out of it and see something. If you can't see, if it's really that opaque, then it's not going to be a halachic window for this sake of this imperative. However, if you recall, the Beis Yosef quotes from the Talmidei Rabbeinu Yonah that why is there a mitzvah to have windows? It's not so that you can see outside, it's that to allow the light in. It's to create a prayer. Praying in the dark is very unsettling, and so you need windows in order to create light. And therefore, some poskim say that in a room with electric lights, there's less of a reason to have windows. So according to Rabbeinu Yonah, if the stained glass windows at least allow enough light in that you can see and you don't feel like you're fumbling around in the dark, so then it would be, according to Rabbeinu Yonah, a valid window for the sake of this halacha. But again, maybe according to Rashi, it wouldn't be. Okay, practically speaking, most shuls have stained glass windows. And again, it's not a violation of Chlukos Akum, almost definitely. And most windows that have stained glass windows, such as our shul, have other windows. So even if you hold like Rashi, there are still other windows that you can look out, so it seems like it wouldn't be a problem, but nevertheless, there are voices of Soloveitchik from within our tradition that have, I think, made very beautiful, very well articulated cases against not just stained glass windows, but the entire Christianization of the Jewish worship space. So we'll leave it at that for today. Next week we don't meet night away because it's next week, and in two weeks, it's going to be Erev Pesach. So I'll send out an email probably with our next date. I'll check the calendar and we'll see. But we'll leave it at that for now. I hope everybody enjoys the eclipse. I do want to say that just some halach notes about the. Let me turn off the recording about the eclipse.